Kiss the Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up later in the show, Chris Gethard, a great comedian, is going to be at the AV Club Fest tomorrow at Talia Hall. We're going to talk with Chris about his career. He's a regular on Broad City on Comedy Central. He also has the Chris Gethard Show, which is great on Fusion, one of my favorite shows. We'll talk with Chris coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Also tonight, Monica Ang and Louisa Chu will be here to talk about McDonald's. We'll also talk about Navy Pier, the 2.0 of Navy Pier with the new Ferris wheel. And we'll talk about third-party delivery services and how some chefs in Chicago are pushing back. They don't want them involved with their business. And how can they stop them from doing so? We'll have that conversation coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Well, you know what? It's always great to be called the capital of the country, the capital of the world, right? We're the hot dog capital of this country, regardless of what people say. But this one, Cook County has the most exonerations in the country, making it the wrongful conviction capital of the U.S. Imagine, if you will, being wrongfully convicted, trying to clear your name while spending time locked up. In Illinois alone, exonerees have lost over 1,700 years to prison. Let that sink in. 1,700 years. False accusations, mistaken IDs, false confessions, and official misconduct all play roles in putting the wrong people behind bars. A new book is out called The Exoneree Diaries, The Fight for Innocence, Independence, and Identity, and it's written by investigative journalist Allison Flowers. In the book, she profiles four exonerees, including Antoine Day, who spent almost 10 years in prison for a crime he did not commit. He was released in 2001. Tonight, it's my pleasure to welcome Allison Flowers and Antoine Day to the big table. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Great to see you. Thanks for being here. Allison, you've been working on, you know, you've spent a lifetime working on exonerees, the Exoneree Project. Talk about where this comes from, where this passion comes from to tell these stories.
Yeah, so I started looking into post-exoneration issues when I was working at the Medill Justice Project at Northwestern. And when I was in that role, I was on the front end. I was investigating potentially wrongful murder convictions. And, you know, that's really valuable work, of course. While I was doing that, it occurred to me one day, as I was preparing to head into the office, you know, I just sort of stopped in my tracks and I thought, you know, we're doing all this work to uncover the truth, to help get innocent people out of prison. But what happens when those innocent people are freed? Where do they go? Mm-hmm. Who do they have in their lives anymore? And so I wanted to explore that question. And this was about almost 4 years ago. It really was one that, you know, just did not have enough attention at all. I did discover, however, that there was an innocence project here in the city at Loyola University called Life After Innocence. And it was dedicated to helping exonerees. And so I thought, okay, that's going to be my first stop for looking at this question. And so I went over there and talked to Laura Caldwell, who heads up that program. She's a local author as well, law professor. And she introduced me to some exonerees. I started interviewing them. And suddenly I realized that this was really an unexplored terrain.
What happens after they get out, of the innocence movement.
You know, we're all familiar with DNA exonerations and sort of this victorious idea of getting out of prison. But there hadn't been much attention on what happens after.
Right. And you know, in the media, you'll see the big case that pops up and there'll be the press conference and an exoneree will be talking and maybe there'll be a lawsuit involved. But that's not the case with every time a conviction is overturned.
Right. It's really the exception, not the rule. So most exonerees are not compensated. And in fact, all exonerees are not compensated when they leave prison. So when you leave prison as an exoneree, there's no compensation. That's automatic anyway. There's no expungement, so your record shows that you have a murder conviction or whatever it is that you were wrongly convicted of. And, you know, beyond that, your family members may have moved on. Your spouse probably has divorced you. Your children don't know you anymore. You can't get a job and provide for yourself, let alone a family. So, you know, it's really not an ending. That's where the prison movies end, right, is when the person gets out of prison. It's really not an ending. It's not a Hollywood thing at all. It's really just the beginning.
Allison, why choose the four exonerees that you chose to profile in this book?
Well, I wanted to choose exonerees from Cook County. And the three men that are in the book are from Cook County. I decided to include a woman in the fray. She's actually from Indiana, but lives in Cook County. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to focus on Cook County because, as you mentioned, it's the wrongful conviction capital of the U.S. It has the highest number of exonerations, about 123 out of the 160 that Illinois has thereabouts. It is, well, Harris County, Texas is kind of trailing right behind at 118. So I think it's a title that we would be very willing to relinquish. But I wanted to focus on that. And also the four people that I chose are so different. Their cases are different. It shows different flaws mm-hmm. in the criminal justice system. You know, one exoneree was wrongly convicted on a mistaken eyewitness identification, another because of perjury, another because of bad arson science. And so I wanted to highlight the flaws in the system through their cases, but also put a name and a face.
Are there, when you talk about percentages and numbers, are there certain causes that are higher than others? I mean, you've mentioned a lot right there, but are there some that you're always like, oh, false confession always is what they point to. What are the number one causes?
Right. So we have something now called the National Registry of Exonerations. It's developed just in the last couple of years, and it's sort of the official tracker of exonerations since 1989. So, of course, a lot is lost in the shuffle, and there's no way to really alert, you know, the tracker when someone has had their case mm-hmm. overturned. So you basically have to hunt for these cases, but they've gotten really good at it. And so there's about an exoneration every 3 days in this country. And so the exoneration registry is just growing and growing. And so by tracking those, you can, of course, look at those cases and see what they have in common and see what the patterns and trends are. And what it shows is that the leading cause of wrongful convictions, as seen in these, you know, 1,800 or so exonerations, is actually perjury or false accusation. So that's just when someone, you know, believes a rumor or has some sort of incentive to lie about you in court and they testify against you on the stand. So oftentimes when exonerees are released, it's because of a recantation. The witness has taken it back. You know, there's other contributing factors as well. There's mistaken ID, as I mentioned, that's in about mm-hmm. a third of cases. There's false confession. Cook County is also the false confession capital of the U.S., something to be proud of. 13% of cases of exonerations involve a false confession.
Right.
There's misleading or bad science or forensics. That's in about a quarter of cases. And then more than half of cases involve some sort of official misconduct.
And that's a big part of Cook County. We've seen that with the cases involving John Burge and torture cases and other things that we've seen over the years where there have been false confessions and official misconduct.
Right. And, you know, that's obviously a very timely issue here in Chicago. New data at the Invisible Institute where I work shows that, you know, 97% of police misconduct complaints go undisciplined. And I think there's a very strong link between police misconduct and wrongful convictions, as we see in these exoneration trends.
The book is called The Exoneree Diaries, The Fight for Innocence, Independence, and Identity. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, Antoine Day, who is one of the profiled exonerees in the book, is here in studio. I want to hear your story, Antoine. I want to hear not only just about, you know, what put you in prison, but also what it was like in there, knowing that you didn't commit the crime and what life has been like after. Antoine Day, also Allison Flowers. And you can see Allison and the exonerees are going to be at Loyola University's Law School, 25 East Pearson, tomorrow night at 6 o'clock. Are you going to – the exonerees will be there all four?
Yes, all four will be there for Q&A. I'll be doing a talk as well, and it's open and free to the public.
That's coming up tomorrow. All right, stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest tonight at the big table, the author of The Exoneree Diaries, The Fight for Innocence, Independence, and Identity. Allison Flowers is an investigative journalist. You can catch her tomorrow night at Loyola University Law School, 25 East Pearson, at 6 o'clock. She will be speaking and also presenting the book and also the exonerees who will be there, including Antoine Day, who is featured in the book, and he's also in studio with us tonight. Antoine, let's turn to you. Why don't we, I mean, I guess the best way to organize this is just tell your story. So mm-hmm. let's pick up on that night that was in front of the liquor store back in, what was that, 1990?
1990, yeah.
Yeah.
So, incident occurred in front of the liquor store, and there was some guys gambling, and said somebody came up to rob the dice game. So it was a shooting, and three people were shot. I think it was three people were shot. And so, you know, it was a big fuss about, you know, who did it.
Now, you weren't there.
No.
Never. But the rumor mill.
Right, the rumor mill.
The next day and the days mm-hmm. after were check yeah. out.
Well, the incident occurred. How Twan name got involved was a vehicle. I had a black Chevy Blazer. And at first they said it was a black deuce and a quarter. Then they said it was a black station wagon. Then it was a black Blazer. Well, hey, Twan got a black Blazer. So, and of which that was parked in front of my house at the time, wasn't even running. So, I mean, things just started occurring. And so when I found out the police wanted to question me, I went into the police station. I didn't run. They didn't track me down like an animal. I went into the police station trusting that, you know, this can be handled right. Mm-hmm. So I sat in a room with an eyewitness who I spoke to over 45 minutes, never knew who he was, and he didn't know who I was. We had a conversation, and we were maybe 5 or 6 feet away from one another, just holding a conversation for about 45 minutes.
And then it went to a lineup.
Yeah. So they came in, they said, you ready to stand in lineup? I said, yeah. And he was the witness, and I was the guy going in the lineup.
Were you at all at this point, and it's hard to think back because we're talking about, you know, years ago now. Were you at all at that point, like, was your antenna up that you're like, this is kind of weird that I've been in the police station for this long, and now they want me to be in a lineup? I mean, what was going through your head at that
time? Yeah, it was definitely weird because, you know, I know how they operate in this community. So it was definitely a weird situation. And
on the west side of Chicago.
Yeah, on the west side of Chicago. In all scenarios. So being in a situation, I just trusted in it, you know, that they couldn't pick me out because I didn't do anything. So here it is. You got a heroin addict who would have said his mom killed Kennedy if caught in that situation, you know, and this guy picked me out. And police put a lot of pressure on those guys, you know, and then when they came and told me that I was positive, it was a positive ID. And I'm like, wow, what? He said it was a positive ID. So they arrested me. So at that point, I ended up going through the system.
Let me, I don't want to give away the whole chat. I mean, your story is so compelling in the book. And it's a great read about how, you know, lawyers, changing lawyers, how everything kind of play. I mean, there's so much there. We're not going to get to everything.
Okay.
But obviously, when you're in the courtroom, and the judge says, you know what, I'm going to get you, you're convicted on murder, attempted murder,
mm-hmm.
And there was another charge,
unlawful use
of a weapon.
A lot of others.
What goes through your head knowing that you just got a 60-year concurrent mm-hmm. sentence?
Well, it was so unreal, I had no emotions. You know how they said he showed, he had no,
like
he didn't show any remorse? You know, it's not that. It's that you're in such a shock, you can't even cry if you wanted to cry. You're really searching for the breath to say, hey, this is the wrong person. You know, you guys got the wrong person. So, I mean, it's really hard, man, because all I could do is just stare at them and look at my mom, you know, and felt like I needed to apologize to my mother for, you know, dragging her through this. And I mean, it was really hard, you know, emotionally. So I dealt with it, you know, and I tried to keep my sanity, but it's rough how the system can really rip your life apart and you not even know it.
Well, I mean, there's still so much to talk about with this story. Let's talk about your time in prison. I mean, going and you were in Pontiac.
Pontiac and Stateville.
Let's talk about it. I mean, at the first parts of it, you were a little bit, right, I wouldn't know how anyone would act if you didn't do the crime, but you were, I guess what you would say, quote unquote, trouble in the mm-hmm. way that you were fighting in prison.
Mm-hmm.
The guard, you know, you had sort of a what they said, a lack of respect.
Right.
Where did that come from for you?
Well, that came, you know, really with the trust factor, you know what I'm saying? And I felt like I had to build this defense up against everybody. It wasn't just the guards. It was other inmates and, you know, just people in general. To where I really tried to isolate myself, you know, because I had no trust. And it was a terrible way to look at people who hadn't done anything to you. But going through the system of prejudice and a lot of murders and rapes in this institution. It was so many things going on, and it was so fast. You know, you couldn't wait to go to sleep. Sleep didn't last long enough, you know, and the things you would hear and things you would see inside of these walls, man, it was just, it gave you a lot to deal with. So I had a rough time, you know.
Adjusting.
Adjusting and dealing with people in general, mostly with the guards, because they would come in. I was a little jealous. They would come in every day from home. They would leave at a certain hour and go home to their families. And I'm sitting here looking at pictures, and then I'm violated because they'll come in and they'll take those personal things and sling them on the floor, put them in the toilet, you know, things like that just to upset you, you know. So at a point, you have to get inside your head and not let them control you. So that's what I did.
Psychologically, you know, at what point, you know, knowing that, you know, you're wrongly convicted, at what point psychologically do you make the decision to continue to fight, or to say this is my surroundings, this is my life?
I never gave up. From the day that they sentenced me, I knew that I'll be back. I knew that I was going to get that case overturned, because I truly feel in my heart that the truth overweighs a lie any day. So I really knew in my heart that I would come home. I knew it was going to take a fight. I had to stay determined, but sometime I would lose that. Right. I would lose that. Right. I would say, I'm just wishful thinking, you know, I'm not going nowhere. So that would begin to turn you into a different type of animal. Now it's the survival game, you know, where, because people they attack you every day, you know, and it's so hard sometimes, really, just to go in your head now to think about, you know, how you had to prepare yourself every day. Because every day that I was in Pontiac for 4 straight years, somebody was stabbed, beat, or killed. I done seen a couple of people shot by guards in the institution. Brains blown out, one shot, and killed them. You know, no warning shots. You don't get those. You get hit, kill shots. So I've seen that so often. I've seen so many bodies laying in the shower, stabbed up. You know, people beat where they couldn't see, they lost their eyesight because the bone structure has been smashed so bad. So I've seen so many things, man, to where I really had to get on my knees and pray that I don't become one of these animals, because it's really a vicious cycle when you're in there and you're learning how to deal. And I was still adjusting to it.
Antoine Day was exonerated in 2001. So he spent almost 10 years in prison. I mean, what we're talking about right here is, 4 years. You just summed up 4 years at Pontiac. I mean, there's mm-hmm. there's even 6 more years of the sentence. We'll continue the conversation after the news. Allison Flowers is the author of The Exoneree Diaries, The Fight for Innocence, Independence, and Identity. And one of the featured and profiled exonerees is Antoine Day, and he's in studio telling his story. When we come back, we've got to talk about what it felt like and what happened after you got out.
Oh, sure.
We'll continue the conversation right here on The Download. Stay with us. It's The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the big table, Allison Flowers. Her new book, The Exoneree Diaries, The Fight for Innocence, Independence, and Identity, is out. Congratulations on the book. I know you've been working on it for a while.
Thank you.
You can see her tomorrow night at Loyola University Law School, which is over 25 East Pearson, right over here, Chicago Pearson, essentially, like, or right in that area, at 6 p.m. And also Antoine Day, who's featured in the book. And we'll continue our conversation with you, Antoine, because, mm-hmm. you know, we talked about all the sort of things that were really negative experiences for you to be in jail, especially in wrongfully convicted. I mean, to be able to hold out hope that one day you'd get out. Music played a big role in keeping you sane.
Yeah, music, you know, music is my life. So music was my escape, you know, and because growing up, I listened to Super CFL, you know, Wee FM, you know, I rocked, I countryed, I did it all. So music was my way out. To get rid of the stress every day, you know. So I pretty much would sleep with my ear, my headphones on, my earplugs in. And I was given an opportunity in prison to create this band, It was called the Power Soul Band. And this band was all the guys who was incarcerated, you know, who were musicians. Because it was a lot going on. It was a lot of fighting and riots and mm-hmm. stuff going on. So I got a chance to talk with a superintendent, Superintendent Kelly, who was a really, really great guy. And he believed in giving you an opportunity, you know, to do something with your time. So he did. He gave us an opportunity to create this band. So I would go around and ask guys, and they was excited, man. So a lot of stuff didn't continue to take place as far as incidents and police stabbings and guys fighting and stuff. You know, it kind of dissipated for a while, you know.
Yeah, right.
But it was that was my out. And music is what I do today, just keeping me level, keeping me on an even keel. You know,
let's move the conversation. I mean, there, like I said before, this is a great story. Your story mm-hmm. is tremendous read, and there's a lot of aspects. So let's jump.
Yeah,
I was going to
kill me if I tell it all. Now.
Yeah, no. Let's jump to the point where you're in the courtroom, mm-hmm. and the judge says, "Free to go."
Oh wow! Yeah, he asked me a question though, and I love to tell this part. He said, "Mr. Day, you have any?" He said, "Are you ready to go home?" You know, I had the wonderful lawyer. Let me not forget about Joseph Howard, who was the best, the Jewish man who I love to death. You know, he came in and told me he was my lawyer. I didn't ask for him. He took my case. And he told me one thing he wanted me to do is pay attention to my case and stay positive. And that's what I did. So when we made it, and every time we went to court, the state's attorneys would laugh at him. They would make jokes about him. And he would look at me and
because
say,
of the way he looked.
Yeah, the way he walked. Acted, you know, yeah. He kind of reminded you of Columbo. He come in, you know, his feet was bad, so he would walk up. He was old, man. He was like 77 then, I believe. And he came in, and every time we go to court, he said, "Are you ready to go home? Did you bring some clothes?" You know, and it was a joke because after the joke, you know, I would go back into the jail, and there I go again for another year, 6, 7, 8, 9 months, however long, until this one day, we didn't even know. He never asked the question. And then the judge asked me, he said, "Mr. Day, are you ready to go home today?" I was knocked off my feet because my mom didn't know, he didn't know, I didn't know.
Yeah, it was unexpected, right? How often does that happen, Allison? I mean, I think in my head that it's a huge media circus. Mm-hmm. People are ready. Everyone's there. Everybody's in their Sunday best. They're ready to, is this going to be it? You're free to go. But that's not how it works.
That's not how it works at all. I would say that most exonerees don't know that it's coming, or they're given maybe 24 hours notice. And of course, that 24 hours when you're about to leave the jail becomes a really dangerous time. You know, you don't want to mess it up, and the prison doesn't want you to get hurt either, because then suddenly you're a liability to them. But yeah, most of the time, exonerees don't have much notice. The exonerees featured in the book, none of them had notice, other than, waiting a new trial, perhaps, or being at mm-hmm. county jail, and some indication that it could be. But after, you know, in Antoine's case, he was behind bars for almost 10 years. The other exonerees, 17 years, 21 years, mm-hmm. 24 years, collectively 80 years behind bars, just with these four exonerees. So, of course, they've seen numerous appeals over the years and lots of disappointments where they did not go home.
For you, I mean, you mentioned, Antoine, you mentioned your lawyer. I mean, how, Allison, from your investigations and your reporting and the stories that you're telling about not just these four but the exonerees, how important is it that lawyer that just says, you know what, I want to take this case for justice? There's no real paycheck in this is about justice.
It's everything. You know, the exonerees in the book, they really are extraordinary because they beat remarkable odds. It's extremely rare to overturn a wrongful conviction. Rob Warden, who's, you know, kind of famous here in the innocence world here in Chicago, started the Center on Wrongful Convictions. He says that, it takes serendipity, really, for a case to be overturned. So it's extremely rare. It does require a lot of good Samaritans along the way who are willing to help. Two of the exonerees in the book are former clients of the Center on Wrongful Convictions at mm-hmm. Northwestern.
Right.
Antoine's case is a little different, though, because it was actually a real estate lawyer who took an interest in his case and, you know, had never done this type of thing before.
And that's why they were snickering in the courtroom. They're like, usually not in this situation. Good
right.
Lord. Right.
He wore moccasins and he would shuffle into the courtroom at 26 in California. So I'm sure it was quite the sight. But, you know, he had never taken a case like this before. And he just kind of believed in Antoine and took up his cause.
Helson, half of this book is about everything that we've talked to up to this point. But the other half is about how people adjust after. No one really takes a look at what happens. So, Antoine, back to your story. You're free to go. What happens? I mean, obviously the details are so well written. The idea of putting on someone else's clothes, walking out, hitching a ride, trying to get back to your mom's house in the West Side. But past that, past the details that you can read in Allison's book, what was going through your head, you know, out of jail for the first time in 10 years, what were you facing?
What do I do now? How do I make it? There was nothing. Actually, the state kept $48 of my money, so I had no money to get on the bus. Absolutely nothing, you know, and I had to figure it all out, which is, I think it's totally unfair. Like Alice said, it's unfair for them to know that they wronged you and then do nothing, just let you go, you know. So if it wasn't for my family and people like Allison, people like Mr. Howard, to step up and say, hey, let's do something about this. Let's tell somebody. Because if you don't tell it, it'll happen over and over and over and over again. And one of the things I really realize now is that most of these state's attorneys that was wrongfully prosecuting people are turning into judges now. It's kind of scary, you know, to think that, you know, we have gotten that far. We're not thinking about who it was that did this. Because it's not just the police.
Is that a part of your healing? I mean, the psychological sort of idea of justice, and it's such a warped concept in your case because, you know, justice served and wrongfully convicted, but the concept of having some sort of justice for someone who went out of their, I mean, you can make the argument, went out of their way to convict you.
Right. And it is. Just being able to talk about it is justice for me. You know, so I don't walk around angry. You know, I don't walk around bitter. None of that.
Was it hard at the first? Was it hard not to sort of say, look at how society wronged me. I'll just play the victim.
No, I never did that. You know, I don't think I was cut from that cloth because I'm a doer. And I knew that I had a fight on my hand. You know, I had to fight. Some things you got to fight for. Says if it's worth having, it's worth fighting for. And my life was worth fighting for. So I don't walk around with the bitterness, none of that. I just want to let people know that we see it now. You can't do something like this to a person and hide it. You can't steal somebody's life and kidnap them and then say there's nothing you can do about it. You know. So, yeah, it's difficult. So what Allison is doing for this country is getting his word out, letting people know that these things are going on. So most people only think they happen to somebody else.
Right.
But it happens to so many people, and you'd be surprised.
Allison, you know, for exonerees that you've interviewed, that you've worked with in your time as a reporter, how, I mean, are they similar stories? I mean, it seems like the resolve that Antoine's talking about would be shared, but it also, I feel like psychologically it's a lot to overcome being in jail for 10, 15, 20, 25 years.
Of course. I mean, I think when you talk to an exoneree like Antoine and the others, I think ultimately they don't want anger and bitterness to have any more real estate in their lives. They don't want to waste the years that they have left on those emotions. But I think you can, obviously, once you start talking to them, the frustration and about the injustice that they faced is still there. And I think it's a burden that doesn't really go away. You know, there's no counseling, no social services for exonerees. But when they leave prison, many are experiencing, you know, symptoms of PTSD like a war veteran does. And yet, true, you know, they're not even, you know, given a bus pass to get home safely to their families.
Does what Allison is saying, it resonates?
Hey, I can't say it any better, you know. So, and it's so true because the trauma it's so internal. You can't see it. Everybody think you walk around and you hating people. That's not what it is. Some people have, they withdraw. You know, we have a lot of people right now that's suffering and asking for help. We come out with a, from the state, we come out with a mental issue, a health, physical issue, because a lot of guys got diabetes, their kidneys, their livers failing, dental, eyes, you know, and you come home with nothing. You come home with nothing. Nobody's standing in line and say, hey, let us help you with that. Let us help you with that. Nobody. So a lot of the situations is some of these guys end up on the street because there's no housing. If you're on parole, you got an option to get housing. But if you just exonerate, yeah, you're just in the street.
We'll see you later, right?
So now they're trying to make put things in place for exonerated people.
You've chosen to work in the field to give back. I mean, you have you know, set up foundations and work with not only exonerees but kids in areas. So talk about why you give back. I mean, I'm interested in the psychological approach to being wrongfully convicted. And then feeling like, you know, you want to give back to a society that wronged you.
So giving back to me is helping somebody help themselves. You know, like when Mr. Joe gave me, he just gave. It wasn't a question why. He just gave. And that's how I give back to the community. Because right now I'm at Better Boys and Girls Foundation, where I'm helping youth and adults, because we run a reentry program as well. I help them with employment. I help them with education. We help them with mental illness.
Do they know your story?
Yeah, most of them. Some of them, you know, say, you know, they didn't see me on TV. They didn't hear it on the radio. You know, different things. But not all of them know it. But and you know, sometimes when we have groups, we'll talk about where we came from and where we're going. So my thing is how I overcome being frustrated anymore is helping somebody else find success in their lives. That's what matters to me. You know, and to get this story out and tell people, you don't have to sit in your funk. You know, you don't have to sit in it. You can shake it off. You can move forward. You can get your life together. And that way I fight what they thought they were going to do to me, how they thought they were going to destroy me. They didn't. So I can help other people save their lives.
Allison, what usually happens to exonerees? You talk about every 3 days in this country. What's the usual course, if there is one, from the data of what happens to exonerees once they're out?
Well, once they're out, you know, they struggle to find jobs. Hopefully they have some family member who can take them in. One exoneree that you'll meet in the book, James Kleppelberg, you know, his lawyers were looking into halfway houses for him without much luck. And he was staying at a hotel temporarily when his estranged son came forward after seeing some of the media attention around his case and invited him into his home. And, you know, his little girls gave up their bed and this, you know, kind of bulky, hulking guy sat, you know, slept on a Tinkerbell bed. But, you know, that's the exception. Many of them end up homeless. You know, in Antoine's case, you know, sleeping at times on his mother's sofa, kind of being in between things a lot of the time. There are about 30 states, Illinois included, and D.C., that do provide compensation to exonerees. So there's 20 states that don't. Mm-hmm. But, you know, even among the states that do have some sort of policy or law to compensate an exoneree, those laws still fall short. You know, in Illinois, the most you can be compensated is about $200,000 for a wrongful conviction, depending on the length of time. So for some of these guys in the book, 21 years, 24 years, that's not even $10,000 a year. Mm-hmm. You know, for your wrongful conviction. And on top of that, you actually have to go through another legal process. You have to find a lawyer who can represent you to prove your innocence again to the court. So if you recall, like, you know, at an original trial, it's, you know, not guilty, right? But in this case, you're having to actually prove your innocence, which after a lengthy incarceration is very difficult to, right. You know, pull up old witnesses who may be... have passed away,
this
right, or don't want
to
talk.
This is just to get the money?
This is just to get the money. You have to prove your innocence all over again. You know, evidence may be destroyed, so it's difficult to prove innocence, and it's a different standard of proof than what's required at trial.
Antoine, I'll give you the last word here. listening to Allison, you know, being a part of this project, obviously sharing your stories, mm-hmm. how does it make you feel after all these years, especially the 10 years that you lost in prison, to be sitting in this studio on Michigan Avenue
great.
Telling your story?
Great. It feels great to be able to speak about it, to have somebody like Allison to really talk about it, because I could never say it the way she said. And the book really says, I mean, she's so in depth in the book that, you know, she dug into all of us and got the story. But it's great to sit here and talk about it, because this is something that a lot of people never thought would happen. So I'm glad to turn the table and say, hey, here it is. You know, you can't hide justice forever, you know, because love, truth, peace, freedom, and justice is what we live by. And I love Allison to death, Hunter's new baby, hers, and hope he'll be able to tell the same stories his mom tells, because this is a gift. And I adore her and her husband, man, and, you know, and she's so empowering. You know, I want to talk about her mom and the whole family, but Allison is this book is a read. It's for somebody to take home, get you a nice bottle of wine, sit by the fireplace, and read, because this will show you how society has to change.
The book is called The Exoneree Diaries, The Fight for Innocence, Independence, and Identity. It's written by investigative journalist Allison Flowers. It also features the story of Antoine Day, who was wrongfully convicted, incarcerated for about 10 years. Antoine, Allison, thanks for being my guest tonight.
Thanks for having us.